I've presented three lessons now, or two, on the existence of God. That's right, two. This is the third one. And apologetics, Christian apologetics is what that's called. And one of my favorite subjects, and a subject that I got interested in as a young man growing up, it's not any big secret that when I grew up and left home and went out to work in the world, that I didn't attend church very regularly for several years. And during that time, I did a lot of thinking and a lot of reading, and I started trying to answer a lot of questions that I had concerning the existence of God and the purpose of life and things like that. And I always thought that it was a shame that stuff like that was never taught to us from the pulpit or in the classes. Things like that, evidences in support of the existence of God and the validity of the Bible, just weren't taught to me growing up as a kid, and it caused a lot of confusion and for me. And my effort here is to provide something for the kids and everybody here that they're taught things like evolution and things like that in the schools. The first lesson that I worked on was called We Are Without Excuse, where we looked at the existence of God based on the existence of things that were made. Well, life is made too. And one of the comments that was in that first lesson was that since that there was life, or since that there was an existence, something had to create it. And it was also presented that there wasn't any real use of discussing evolution until we could explain the origins of the universe. Well, we worked on that, and now we're going to talk about life. And to start that out, let's open our Bibles to Genesis 1 and 11. Those of you who want to follow along, and we're just going to read God's account of how life came about on the earth. Genesis 1, starting in 11. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. And God said, Let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And God said, Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales, and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas. Let the fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And God said, Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Genesis 2:1. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. It's not complicated, is it? That's pretty straightforward, pretty easy to understand. But that's not how the kids are taught in the school. That's not how people think the things happened. That is how God said he did it. God said he created the life on earth, and that he created it all by the end of day six. That is what we teach in the church. However, this is not what is taught to our children in school. If it were not for the church, our children would never hear of God's creation account. What they do hear is the theory of evolution, which is taught as fact in the schools. Charles Darwin authored a book called The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. It introduced the theory that populations of different species of animals, including man, evolve over the course of generations through a process of natural selection. The supposed evidence Darwin presented in his book generated scientific, philosophical, and religious discussion, which led to widespread acceptance that evolution of species from common ancestors had occurred, and contributed significantly to the emerging belief in a fully naturalistic origin of life as the primary explanation for the development of all life on earth. The theory that evolution of species occurs became accepted by the scientific community and much of the general public in Darwin's lifetime. His theory of natural selection came to be widely seen as the primary explanation of the process of evolution, and now forms the basis of modern evolutionary theory. In modified form, Darwin's work is recognized as a unifying theory of the life sciences, providing the unbeliever's view as a logical explanation for the diversity of life. Logical is what they say. Just how logical is this explanation for the diversity of life? What are unbelievers willing to accept in order to do away with the creation account of God? Well, we're going to look at that a little bit. See just how logical that really is. George Simpson, evolutionist, professor of paleontology at Columbia University, professor of paleontology at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, and professor of geosciences at University of Arizona, wrote this definition of evolution several years ago. This guy is a evolutionist to the core. He wrote, evolution is a fully natural process, inherent, that is built in to the physical properties of the universe, by which life arose in the first place, and by which all living things, past and present, have developed divergently and progressively. Fully natural process. Dr. Simpson said, by which life arose in the first place. Well, before there can be any evolution, there first must be something alive to evolve. In science, This is called spontaneous generation of life. In other words, lifeless matter has to organize itself into something living as a result of fully natural processes without any outside direction or guidance of any kind whatsoever. Scientists eager to believe in evolution have gotten the cart before the horse. They have propagated and pushed this theory on people who are willing to discount a creator God, and they cannot even provide a logical explanation for how life organized itself and arose from non-living matter all by itself. Evolution has some serious hurdles to overcome, but the most important one is to be found at the beginning. The purpose of this lesson is going to be to deal with spontaneous generation of life, which has to happen first before any evolution of species by natural selection can occur. And I want to tell you that even after life gets started, evolution still has some big hurdles to overcome to get from that to what we see today. But we don't need to do that before we worry about that, which might come in a lesson in the future. We're going to deal with the spontaneous generation of life. It should be noted here, before we go any further, that not all the scientists believe in evolution as the means of which life got here. An important factor to consider in bringing about the universal dominance and acceptance of Darwinian evolution has been that virtually every eminent professional scientist appointed to posts in the life sciences in the last 40 to 50 years in the English-speaking world has been a convinced Darwinist. These men, as well as occupying powerful and important academic teaching positions, were also prolific and important writers whose influence has been widespread in forming the modern-day scientific consensus. The scientists and professors who support evolution are the ones who occupy the most influential and far-reaching teaching positions in the scientific world. Excuse me. There are many, many scientists who do not believe in evolution. They do not believe in evolution, but their voices and their writings are not universally accepted. Therefore, they are not heard among their peers among the world. One such example is the late Dr. Arthur E. Wilder Smith, an honored scientist with an amazing 3 earned doctorates. He held many distinguished positions. A former evolutionist, Dr. Wilder Smith debated various leading scientists on the subject of evolution throughout the world. In his opinion, the evolution model did not fit as well with the established facts of science as did the creation account of Genesis. He quoted, "The evolutionary model says it is not necessary to assume the existence of anything besides matter and energy." That's the evolution model. Don't have to have anything but matter and energy to produce life. That proposition is unscientific. We know perfectly well that if you leave matter to itself, it does not organize itself in spite of all the efforts in recent years to prove that it does. Despite strong pressure to accept evolutionism, many intelligent and experienced scientists either openly or secretly dismiss evolution as a highly unlikely or impossible. In the 1980s, researcher and lecturer David Watson noted an increasing trend that continues today, disturbing those who want evolutionism to be perceived as the accepted scientific consensus. There's been a tidal wave of new books that threaten to shatter that confidence in these men that have that have propagated this evolutionism. Titles like "Darwin Retried," "The Neck of the Giraffe, Where Darwin Went Wrong," "The Great Evolution Mystery," "The Bone Peddlers Selling Evolution," "Fix, Darwin Was Wrong, A Study in Probabilities," "Darwinism, The Refutation of a Myth," Lovetrip was the author, "and Adam and Evolution." Not one of these books was written from a Christian apologetic point of view. They were concerned only with scientific truth, as was Sir Ernst Chain when he called evolution a fairy tale. Biochemist Dr. Arthur Wilder Smith wrote, "Life rides upon matter, and matter has to be highly organized to carry life." The materialists say that life, since it's made up of atoms, molecules, and chemical reactions, is just simply chemistry and nothing else, and that life originated by chance chemical reactions. Now, if life consists merely of chemistry and nothing but chemistry, the best way to understand its real potentialities is to look at some of the chemical substances of life, and we shall see that it is not merely a matter of chemistry. A quote by Wilder Smith. The components which make up a living cell are not just chemicals mixed in a solution. Each living cell must be a self-contained system organized with a process for the consumption of fuel, the expulsion of waste from that spent fuel, and a system for self-reproduction. Even the simplest living cell is an extremely complex life form consisting of an exterior membrane and a nucleus in the center. Contained within that nucleus are the all-important chromosomes. Chromosomes are microscopically small, rod-shaped structures which carry the genes. Within the chromosomes is an even smaller structure called DNA. This is one of the most important chemical substances in any living cell. Increasing scientific understanding of DNA molecules has revealed enormous problems for those who believe in the spontaneous generation of life. DNA is a super molecule which stores coded hereditary information. It consists of two long chains of chemical building blocks paired together. In humans, the strands of DNA are almost 2 yards long, yet less than a trillionth of an inch thick. In function, DNA is somewhat like a computer program on a floppy disk. It stores and transforms encoded information and instructions. It is said that the DNA of a human stores enough information code to fill 1,000 books, each with 500 pages of very small, closely printed type. The DNA code produces a product far more sophisticated than that of any computer. Amazingly, this enormous set of instructions fits with ease within a single living cell and routinely directs the formation of entire adult humans, starting with just a single fertilized egg. Even the DNA of a single-celled bacterium is highly complex, containing at least 3 million units, all aligned in a very precise, meaningful sequence. Many scientists are convinced that cells containing such a complex code and such intricate chemistry could never have come into being by pure, undirected chance. No matter how chemicals are mixed, they do not create DNA spirals or any intelligent code whatsoever. Only DNA has ever been proven or observed to reproduce DNA. Two well-known scientists calculated the odds of life forming by natural processes. They estimated that there is less than one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power that life could have originated by random trials. 10 to the 40,000th is a 1 with 40,000 zeros after it. The odds of winning the lottery are millions of times greater than the odds of 10 to the 40,000th power. Millions of times. 40,000 zeros are a lot of zeros. Chemist Dr. Grebe quoted that organic evolution could account for the complex forms of life in the past and present has long since been abandoned by men who grasp the importance of the DNA genetic code. Researcher and mathematician I.L. Cohen wrote, "At the moment when the DNA-RNA system became understood, the debate between evolutionists and creationists should have come to a screeching halt. The implications of the DNA-RNA were obvious and clear. Mathematically speaking, based on probability concepts, there is no possibility that evolution was the mechanism that created the approximately 6 million species of plants and animals that we recognize today. Evolutionist Michael Denton quoted, "The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it is impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle." Hello. Famed researcher Sir Fred Hoyle is in agreement with the creationists on this point. He has reportedly said that supposing the first cell originated by chance is like believing a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. The notion that the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial soup here on the earth is evidently nonsense of a high order. These are all quotes by scientists, ones that we don't hear anything about. Wonder why. Fred Hoyle made another brilliant illustration, and I love this one, on the probability of life emerging as a spontaneous generation. He compared the chances of a single amino acid combination, of which there are hundreds that life depends on, hundreds. He compared the chances of a single amino acid combination being arranged naturally to a solar system full of blind men, each solving a Rubik's Cube simultaneously. As stated earlier, there is no point in debating evolution until it can be demonstrated that life can spontaneously generate itself. Things which are not living cannot organize themselves and become living. The simplest, most basic single-celled living organisms are far too complicated for such a thing to happen. If one were to take all the ingredients in a living cell and mix them in a solution together, they would not spontaneously come together and start forming living cells. Typical cells are made up of components called organelles. Some of them are as follows, if I can say some of these. Nucleolus, nucleus, ribosomes, vesicles, rough endoplasmic reticulums, Golgi apparatus, cytoskeleton, smooth endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria, vacuoles, cytoplasm, limosomes, and centrioles within centrosomes. There's a lot of stuff going on inside of a living cell. If scientists were to take all of these organelles or individual components of living cells and mix them all together in a single container and leave them standing for a period of time, what would be the chances of a single cell to organize itself perfectly within this mix and spontaneously start living all on its own without any direction from without? I would say that would be an impossibility of great magnitude. So those who advocate evolution want us to believe that they can spontaneously generate themselves from the simple matter and chemicals that make up these tiny organelles or cellular components. All of the chemicals and matter which make up a living cell must organize themselves into all of these tiny little organelles, components, and then they must further organize themselves into a living cell, capable of metabolizing food and reproduction. And then this tiny little concoction must spontaneously, with no outside direction whatsoever, begin to live. It must somehow go from something non-living to something living spontaneously all on its own. Now I ask you, how logical is the theory of evolution? And I find it to be the most unbelievable fairy tale ever told. A fairy tale conceived and propagated by people who want so much to disprove the existence of God that they are willing to grasp at anything in order to dispose of God. Romans 1:20, For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Understood by the things that are made, so that they are without excuse. This verse of Scripture was a subject of an entire lesson not long back on the existence of God. We looked at the evidence that supported His existence from a scientific and logical perspective through the existence of the universe. We saw in that lesson that the universe was indeed made and created, and that something that is created must have a creator. Now, just like before, we're going to look at the origination of life and considering it in the same context. God said He created life. That means all life, including us, is made. Life exists. We exist. We are here. Therefore, we had to have an origin. Physical life is not eternal, meaning it has a beginning and it has an ending. Life is therefore an effect, and all material effects must have an adequate and preceding cause. I was a young boy when my grandfather, Glenister, died. During his life, he was a jeweler, and he also worked on watches. He had this really neat framed picture of the inner workings of a Bulova Accutron clock. I found that picture in his effects, and I remember poring over that picture for hours in fascination of the inner machinery of that timepiece. I was captivated with how complex that timepiece was, and I remember thinking how smart the person was who figured out how to build one of those things. The picture had this little spring that had to be wound up with a pendulum that turned back and forth, and one could see all the tiny little levers and gears and workings that would transfer the stored energy in the clock spring to the hands of the clock. I think just about anybody would agree that a clock is something that is designed with thought and intent by an intelligent designer. Just suppose I brought a clock in here and showed it to everybody and tried to tell you that it was caused by random forces of nature acting without purpose or intent to construct and organize all its components, assemble it, and then wind it up and start it. I think it's safe to say that something like that is an impossibility. I bet there's not one school-aged kid in this room right now that would buy that. Now let's up the ante a little. Let's say this clock not only keeps time, but it is capable of consuming fuel, rewinding itself, moving itself around, disposing of its own waste, and capable of self-reproduction. That's not a clock. There's not a clock today that can do anything like that. Such a clock is beyond man's ability to build. But living cells can. Living cells are far more complicated than any clock. Scientists today cannot get life started in their laboratories. With all of science's advances, they cannot build the components of a living cell from raw materials, assemble them, and get them started living. The finest minds of mankind have been unable to achieve this, and evolutionists would have us believe that such a thing was organized by blind chance from molecules and chemicals without any superimposing direction of any kind. Living cells, which are the building blocks of life and clocks, show the inherent qualities of intelligent design. Therefore, what causes living cells or a clock must not only be greater than they and be there before they are, it must also be intelligent enough to cause it. Clocks exist. They haven't been around forever, and we know everything with a beginning must have a beginner. A clock cannot be created and wound up by blind forces of nature acting randomly. Therefore, the existence of the clock proves that there had to be someone smart enough to design it, build it, and start it. The complexity of its design disallows a random, undirected cause. Similarly, life exists. Life, which is far more complex than any clock, cannot be created and started by blind forces of nature acting randomly. It is beyond the realm of possibility, and we don't have to be scientists to see this and understand it for ourselves. God said we are without excuse, that we're supposed to be able to look at the things that are made and draw the conclusion that there is a God. Life is something that was made. All we have to do is apply the exact same reasoning with living cells that we would do with anything else made or caused or created. Just like this podium right here. It didn't just happen. All we have to do is apply the same thought process to a living cell as we do with anything that we see in this room, the universe, anything that was made. Anything with a beginning has to have a beginner. If it didn't have a beginner, then it's eternal. It's been here all the time. And when we have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains must be the truth. Spontaneous generation of life is impossible. It is a myth, a fairy tale. Evolution is the faith of unbelievers in the non-existence of God. Psalms 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. That's the lesson for this evening. If there is anybody here that is not a Christian or that wants to become one, we'll extend the invitation at this time. If there's anybody here who needs the prayers of the church, then that opportunity is being extended at this time. Anybody with any need whatsoever, let it be known now as we stand and sing the song of encouragement.